Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century look at history's greatest rock and roll bands.
Excuse me.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
guitar three.
Up. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the colorful, even glamorous, Ballad of Mott the Hoople and Ian Hunter.
I know I get more money now from that stuff than I did at the time. I do know that. So it's still, you know, it's still out and about there. It's still moving. I didn't really see Mick for many, many years, but then after Ramp, he liked Ramp a lot, so he started coming out with me again when we do England, you know, we did a couple of tours, and now he'll come when he feels like it, you know, just get up. Great mates, but he's still trying to get me to sing the blues now, and I can't, you know, I'm no good at it. Hello, this is Ian Hunter. I'm in the studio, and we're talking about the best of Mott the Hoople and the best of Ian Hunter.
That's all.
In the early 1970s, there was a very British rock and roll scene that owed little to the immediate predecessors of psychedelia or protest music or Woodstock. Known as glam rock, short for glamorous, it had a fondness for the three-chord simplicity of rock and roll's originators, but a fashion sense that was outrageous and often androgynous, all eyeshadow and sequins and feather boas and stacked heels. And the girls, too. The holy trinity of glam rock was David Bowie as Ziggy Stardust, Mark Bolan as T-Rex, and a loose and lovable quintet with the equally outrageous name of Mott the Hoople, in its prime fronted by a singing piano player, Ian Hunter Patterson, who neither made any attempt to hide his fondness for Jerry Lee Lewis nor his thick West Country accent. I asked Ian Hunter, which he took as his stage name, to discuss his life with a most un-rock and roll father.
Where did you grow up? Because I know Mott came from a different town entirely than you're from.
We weren't that far apart, actually. They came from Hereford. I came from Shrewsbury. They're both West Country, about 60 miles apart.
What did your father do for a living? I understand that you had an interesting childhood growing up.
He was a non-commissioned officer. He was a captain in the war, and then he was a policeman, and then he wound up in MI5.
And what is that for us Yanks? What is MI5? What's it? What would it be comparable to here in the States?
CIA.
Wow.
FBI.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
CIA, I would think, yeah.
What's it like living in that kind of a household?
Well, I wasn't, because he was a policeman when I'd gone already when he went to MI5. I'd left already. He was a copper when I was. He wasn't very nice to live with because it wasn't really his fault. They would do these three shifts, 2 weeks nights, 2 weeks days, 2 weeks in between. He could never sleep properly. He could never, you know. It was awkward for him, and he would get like, and he would take his job home. He was one of those guys. I'm the same, you know. There's a gene in our family. We can't just leave it at work. We take it home with us. So he was a piece of work. I got out of there when I was 16, but it wasn't really his fault. I mean, I was an idiot. You know, he's been through the war, and then he gets confronted by Elvis fans. You know, so this is too much, and I don't blame him. You know, and my mother would flutter. You know. So it was best if I left, you know. He meant really well, but he was, you know, he started in Hamilton in Scotland, and he didn't even have a pair of shoes or a pair of trousers till he was seven. You know, he hauled himself out of the gutter. So it was pretty hard for him to see me prancing about at the age of 17, you know, going to snooker hall and not learning at school and, you know, just generally not being grateful for the fact that we, you know, won the Second World War. single-handed. As they all do.
Sweet and good.
the Hoople with Rock and Roll Queen, you know what I mean, from their 1969 debut. The band got the name from a William McManus novel, which record producer Guy Stevens had read while in a jail cell for pot possession. Unlike most who become professional musicians, Ian Hunter was simply a pop music fan when he left home.
When you left home, did you head for London like any red-blooded Englishman?
I went to Butlins, which is a holiday camp for poor people. And we won a talent. I met two guys there from a place called Northampton, which is considerably nearer London. It's about 60 miles from London. We had this trio, and we sort of sung Blue Moon, and we won the talent thing. So from there, I got out of my house in Shrewsbury and went to live in Northampton with these two guys. And that was how I got my freedom. Freedom to me is like the most valuable thing in the world, you know. And that, it was fabulous. It was like we had nothing, skint and really skint. I mean, not like skint like they are now. I'm talking really skint. But it was freedom. It was fabulous, you know.
Did you want to be a professional musician even at that age?
Oh, no.
What were your plans?
I just worked in factories, you know. Hung out in pubs with my mates. Stretch was one of them. I began to get into music, but only purely as a fan, you know. The jukeboxes then, you know.
Right.
And I'd have my favourite. I was a Jerry Lee Lewis fan. I was a Little Richard fan. You know, PJ Proby. I love PJ Proby. A lot of people. A lot of great people, you know.
So what was the turning point? There had to be something that said, knocked you out and said, wow, I want to do that.
There's a guy called Screaming Lord Sutch, actually.
Yeah.
Because his timing was perfect. I just saw this guy. He had a great band. He couldn't sing for the life of him. It's kind of like Screaming Jay Hawkins, you know, the coffin and the whole bit. And I was looking at him. I was thinking, he can't sing. There's got to be a way to get into this business. You know, this is great. I love the idea of it, you know, going behind the backstage and all that kind of thing. And about a couple of years after that, I was in a pub and I saw this guy and he had like hammers and chisels all around his, he had a belt like a steel erector. And it was Sutch's piano player who had fallen off the stage in Liverpool and gone to hospital, and Sutch had immediately fired him. And he was back doing his, you know, the regular old sort of job that he'd had before. And I just happened to bump into him and I said, why don't you come and live with me in Northampton? You know, we'll clean up. So he said, well, what do you play? I said, bass, more in hope than anything. And I just went up and down the bottom E string, you know, and he just played like, he's like a Jerry Lee Lewis type guy, a piano. And I just played along with him, started picking up the bass a little bit, you know. And then we went to Hamburg. That would have been about 65, 66, 67. And that's when I started thinking, well, you know, maybe. You know. I didn't really think certain, just I thought maybe, you know, might get lucky.
We'll be right back.
Death May Be Your Santa Claus. What a great title. Comes from Mott the Hoople's 1971 Brain Capers album. It was their fourth in 3 years.
So I know for a fact that you were not Mott's original lead singer. How did this kind of, you know, in through the outdoor, this backstage entry into show business, how did it intersect with Mott the Hoople?
When I got down to London, I worked in a factory for a couple of years, and Fred was working down there. We'd do gigs in colleges, places like that. But we were beginning to get fed up with Fred, because Fred just did Jerry Lee Lewis, and me and the guitar player, Miller Anderson, we decided we'd start. He was a great blues singer, so I started backing him, and we started doing these kind of places. And after a couple of years, there were the one guy I knew that had a studio in London just rang me up one day and said, look, there's a weird band down here, and they want a pianist singer, and they're getting guys who can play good piano but they can't sing, or they're getting guys who can sing but they don't play the piano. They've tried everybody. Do you fancy coming down? And so I went down, and that was Mott the Hoople, or the beginning of it, you know. And I auditioned for him. I think I did. It was either Laugh at Me, you know, the Sonny Bono Laugh at Me, or Like a Rolling Stone, Bob Dylan. I think I did one of those two. And they didn't really actually take me, but they figured I might be all right for the time being until they found somebody better, you know. And that's how it was for about a year, you know. Guy Stevens would say, no, he's not good enough, he sits on the piano, we've got to get rid of him. And then the band would stick up for me, and then 5 minutes later the band would be going, oh, we've got to get rid of him. And Guy would be sticking up for me, you know. It was a real dodgy existence. And yeah, it was weird. And I felt the same way. I mean, I felt half the time I'm dragging these people down the road after me, and the other half I thought they were way ahead of me and I was like behind them. Because they're very kind of like insular Hereford people, they're farming people. And they keep to themselves. I mean, we didn't really become bosom friends or anything like that, you know. In fact, Stan, the original singer, was the only guy that spoke to me when I first joined.
And I read where, even though he got bumped out as the lead singer, they kept him around to be manager, a road manager or something?
Yeah, he was an amazing guy, Stan Tippins, and he's become somewhat of a legend in the industry over the years. He just likes to mess things up. You know, and which is a real good attribute for a tour manager, you know, because it's boring on the road. And he will find things to do that you just can't imagine. He just thinks, he's one of those great guys, just thinks differently. So as soon as we could get a few bob together, we had to get him back. And we got him back, you know, as a tour manager. And he stayed with us till the end. And then he went with the Pretenders. And then he wound up with, I think he's been with Sade for about 20 odd years. I still drag him out, you know, when I'm playing England. I make him go. I don't think he wants to, but I force him. He has a yellow card and a red card, you know, like, you have to behave yourself. He weighs you every Thursday. The whole band, if anybody's gain weight, it's $5 a pound. Oh. You know, it's that kind of stupidity, you know. Makes the time go, you know. Makes the time go by when you're travelling and stuff.
Just leave and never
Mott the Hoople's One of the Boys from 1972 is one of the best B-sides of any single you'll ever hear, but it almost never happened, as Mott's options were slim and fortunes were none. But fate would have a young dude intervene. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Ian Hunter for the best of Mott the Hoople.
Hello, this is Ian Hunter. I'm in the studio, and we're talking about the best of Mott the Hoople and the best of Ian Hunter.
Mott got the record deal. You cut several albums, but it just didn't sell, at least over here in America. You didn't break through. Mott the Hoople was just about ready to break up. Isn't that correct?
They had broken up. They broke up. We were doing Gas Tanks.
What's that?
Switzerland. Do you know them big round tin things that you store gas in? Huge big things, big round things.
And you could play in there?
Well, they converted them. They'd become clubs.
Wow.
So we were playing in Switzerland. And the Swiss, they're not really the most animated of an audience, you know. And Mott was one of those kind of bands that, you know, everybody used to jump about, you know. So to play to the Swiss, it wasn't much fun. So we decided to split. And we then became bosom friends immediately, which we hadn't been for a while. And we got back to London, and Pete Watts, the bass player, rang up David, because David was looking for a bass player, David Bowie, and he said, "I'm looking for a job," and David said, "Well, why aren't you, you've left Mott," and he said, no, Mott split, and so David said, "Oh, you can't do that, you know," and so David offered us Suffragette City to get us back together, and I said, "Well, it's not good enough, you know," because it wasn't. I mean, we'd had like two or three songs that hadn't been hits. We'd had the airplay. Now the airplay was, we weren't getting it, you know. We knew it was going to take something special. An average song was not going to work. And so then he came back with All Young Dudes. And that was in Regent Street. I remember in an office, De Vries was working for some publishing company at the time, and we went round there, and David just sat on the floor and played All Young Dudes. And my first thought was, I can sing this. And then my second thought was, like, what? He's not going to give us this, surely. You know, this is stupid. But apparently he'd been trying it, and it wasn't quite working for him. So we just happened to be around at the right time. So we got the song. It was recorded in two evenings, that and One of the Boys, at Olympic in London.
Don't wanna stay alive when you're 25. And when you're stealing clothes from Marks and Sparks, and Freddy's got spots from ripping up the stars from his face, funky little boat race. The television man is crazy, same with juvenile delinquent Rex. Oh man, I need TV when I got T-Rex. Oh brother, you get. Stones, we never got it off on that revolution stove. What a drag! Too many snacks. Nah, I drunk a lot of wine and I'm feeling fine. Gotta raise some cap to bed. Oh, is there concrete all around, or is it in my we
With the title song written and 1972 album produced by David Bowie, that's All the Young Dudes by Mott the Hoople. Here's Ian Hunter.
And of course, All the Young Dudes is just a international classic. That was a big one, yeah. Unbelievable.
He finished doing it, though. He was fed up with it, so he was going, I think it's one of the boys. I think one of the boys is the singer. I'm sitting there thinking, you're out of your mind. If ever there was a song that you were sitting behind before it came out that you knew, you know, was a hit, that was it.
When you went from couldn't get arrested to suddenly All the Young Dudes pop, I mean, the difference was night and day.
Well, it wasn't very good, actually. It wasn't. It wasn't like that at all. I mean, for all of a sudden, we were gay. Now we were gay. You know. And we couldn't even be bothered arguing that one, you know. But we were gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but we were gay. So all the old fans hated us immediately. I mean, this is rock and roll, you know.
I hadn't thought of that.
This went on for about a year. And then the other thing was, you can't do anything without David. You know, it's impossible to do anything without David. They're just living off David. So now we had to write one ourselves, you know. So it was a pretty tense time, actually. Yes, we gained a few fans, but, I mean, it was the Top of the Pops type fans, you know what I mean? Those people kind of come and go, you know. We'd upset our regulars, and that was serious, you know. So it wasn't much fun at the time. And we were even thinking about it ourselves. We were thinking, you know, maybe we lost something here. You know, that was what the Ballad of Mott was all about. But I don't think we could have carried on without a hit. No band could in those days. You know, you had to have that hit. We were filling everywhere. We were filling the Albert Hall. But we didn't have a hit. I don't think it lasts, you know. So, you know, it had to come, you know. And that was it. And I'm really happy that we did it, not because of the glam thing and all the rest of it, but because it's a great song, you know. And I still like that. I still enjoy doing the song.
Yeah.
Save a Stone was a big hit from the 1973 album simply called Mott. Again, Ian Hunter.
Did you ever see Jerry Lee Lewis when he played England?
He's amazing. I just loved his arrogance. You know, I saw him once at the Palladium, and the band came on. The band played 40 minutes. I mean, they figured the band would play one or two songs before he came on, you know. He waited 40 minutes to come on. He came on, stood there and combed his hair, sat down and said, you know, the Palladium sold out tonight. The kids are going crazy. Right up the front, and you know why it's sold tonight? You know, it's sold because the Killer's in the building. You know, like, this is before he's even played a note. The whole place is in total chaos. I think he only ever did about five songs. He was unbelievable. I mean, I just couldn't believe him on the arrogance. And I used a lot of that arrogance with Mott, you know.
We'll be right back.
Well, Memphis came from a gig that we did in Memphis, actually. Most of it was true. We were quite big in Memphis in those days. Cleveland and Memphis, before the coasts. We played Memphis one night, and the place was half empty, and we couldn't understand it, and it was like nothing was working, nothing was happening, and all of a sudden, they found out the turnstiles had broken or something, so they let him in, and all of a sudden, the gig was incredible. It was packed, you know, and we came in from the back and got mobbed to the front. It was one of those magic one-offs, you know, and the band were all in different towns, and they were coming in, and Mick Wells wanted to go home, so I didn't think he was going to turn up because of the flying situation. Mick hated flying. But magically, there we were, all on the stage, and it was a fantastic night. So I wrote the song all the way from Memphis about that particular night. The gear was somewhere in the north, and it was Christmas Eve. We didn't think the gear was going to get there, because with the chaos of Christmas and everything. So that was another thing. The gear got there. Everything got there. One of those gigs you just don't think is going to work, and it just turns out great. Joe Walsh, was that the night Joe Walsh was with us? I'm not sure. I think it was. Because that's when we went to Elvis's house. That's when we broke into Elvis's house. Oh, dear. Well, after that particular gig, we were feeling really good, you know, and there was a whole floor at the local, and I forget what the hotel was, but tons of people there, including some of Elvis's relatives, cousins or whatever. And a lot of those people look after the gate. And they said, if you want to go around there, we can get you in, you know. And the next thing I know, I've had a couple, you know, and I'm inside his house, which, you know, you can get done for that. And dogs were barking. Fortunately, they realised that I was an idiot. But I was inside the house, shag carpet on the walls, floor and ceiling. I saw a gymnasium on to the right, and then there was another door. Fortunately, this door was locked. So being half cut, I actually knocked on the door. And Alberta came, who was his maid. She came and answered it. She was really nice, actually. And she said, he's just been to the movies. He didn't like the movie. And I could see I was sobering up as she said this. It was like I could see my bouncing me off walls and God knows what else. So by this time, the van had come from the front. And these very worried people were trying to get me into the van. Because, you know, they figure they're going to lose their jobs. And I don't know if you've ever been to Graceland.
I used to live and work radio in Memphis. I know exactly where Graceland is, up on the hill, yes.
Well, you remember at Christmas there would be a nativity scene?
Oh, yes.
Remember that on the right-hand side?
Of course.
Well, I came round from the back, down the main drag, with the van behind me, because I wouldn't get in the van. I thought, if I get in the van, they'll kill me. So the nativity scene was there, and the van was right behind me, and I was like silhouetted walking down in front of it towards the main gate, and nobody had a bloody camera. What a cover that would have been, you know.
This is when Elvis was alive.
Oh, yeah, and he wasn't very happy. Oh, no, I could hear the dogs barking. I mean, it must have just reached that point of being drunk where you just didn't give two monkeys, you know. And then, like, talking to Alberta sobered me, so the trip back was like, you know, how do I get out? I knew I was being an idiot, you know. But I'd written a book about that time. That was the end of the book, so it was great, you know. It gave me that kind of the little thing at the end of the book that you always want, you know.
Ladies and gentlemen, the golden age. Rock and roll.
Yeah!
A joyous rave-up. That's the golden age of rock and roll, which appears on the 1974 Mott album entitled The Hoople. Still to come, a main man moves on. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and much more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Ian Hunter, in the studio for the best of Mott the Hoople.
Hello, this is Ian Hunter. I'm in the studio, and we're talking about the best of Mott the Hoople and the best of Ian Hunter, including the classic Shrunken Heads.
While the band members were finally experiencing the success you'd always desired, things were internally, there was some frustrations and some problems. You had one member leave. Mick was having some frustration. What were the signs internally that you can now tell us about?
We didn't realize what it was at the time, but what we do now. And that was basically that Mick was a blueser and I wasn't. But we didn't realize that at the time. Fally, Verdon Allen, was the first one to leave. He felt that, like a lot of the fans did, that we'd let him down having the hit and everything, you know. Then one or two things was going to happen. Mick was going to write hits, or I was. Somebody had to, you know. We already got the start with David. And then I started writing. I had Arnold Lucci Burger, then I had All the Way from Memphis, then I had, like, Roll Away the Stone, then I had Golden Age of Rock and Roll. Mick was getting fed up because he wasn't getting, like, a look at him. When he did, I mean, he had some great songs, but I couldn't sing them because I wasn't a blues singer. So one tour we did, Paul Rodgers and Peace. Paul had a trio called Peace, and he was opening for us, and Mick just started talking to Paul, and the next thing you know, I said to Stan, is he leaving? And Stan said, no, he'll never leave this band as long as he lives. And I said, I don't know about that. 5 minutes later, he was gone, and that was a drag because he'd co-written. Now, you know, like, I was going to have to write it all, so things would have to slow down. And Mick, of course, went into bad company, and those songs I couldn't sing, Paul could. And they became massive, you know, stuff like Can't Get Enough of Your Love and all that.
Bye. Good evening. Nice to be back at Hammersmith again.
How you doing?
Yeah, that was Driving Sister.
Mott the Hoople doing Driving Sister in December 1973 at the Hammersmith Odeon.
How did you get Mick Ronson into Mott?
Well, I knew Mick Rock. You know the photographer, Mick Rock?
Yeah.
Bowie had retired for the first or second time. I forget which it was. And so, I mean, you automatically thought Mick was up to something because Mick was great, you know.
Right.
But Mick Rock was telling me, and this girl was going, you should go around there. He's doing nothing. He's just sitting there, you know. And it had gotten to the point with Luther where Luther's a great player. I mean, and he was great for the band. He gave 120%. But I don't know. I was just looking for something else. And so I went around to see him, and that was it, really, you know. Stayed there all night. De Vries was in America. We rang up De Vries. Mick really wanted to do it. Mick was all for showing David he could do it somewhere else, you know what I mean? So Mick was definitely very enthusiastic. And so then he was in the band, you know. Unfortunately, he didn't get on with the rest of the band. This was something I'd never thought about. They were tired. We'd been around. We'd had a couple of years of failing, and then we'd had, like, a couple of years of running around like maniacs, and so people were tired. And somehow it just didn't work out. You know, Mick had his own label, RCA. We were on Columbia. He had different management. He had De Vries still. We had a different manager. And there was a lot of bitching, inter-bitching, stupid stuff that really didn't matter. But it kind of ruined it, you know. So we did a European tour, and then that was the end of it. Mott folded, 75, I think, something like that.
Right.
Just
original Once Bitten, Twice Shy from Ian Hunter's 1975 first solo album. It went top 20 in the UK and did even better 14 years later in the US, done by Great White. Here's Ian Hunter.
Yeah, first album was fun. You know, I think it took a while. I wrote Once Bitten when we were actually recording it, during the recording. You know, we only went in with five songs. We wrote the rest when we were in there. 6 weeks, I think, first album. All in, mixed a lot, you know what I mean, everything done. But like I say, I had to write half of it when we were in there. Because Mick said, well, we're in an emotional crisis at the moment, so we should record now. And I'm thinking, well, what are we going to record? And we had songs, but we never used any of them. You know, I kept kicking them out as we went, and kept writing them when we were in there. We're very lucky, really. I mean, it could have gone the other way. I remember Mick played bass on that. He's a great arranger, Mick. Absolutely great as an arranger. He more or less ran that solo album, the first one. I remember going into Columbia and they I go in this room and they're like all clapping me because of the first album, you know. And I go, well, yeah, but I have to tell you, like, half this album's owing to Mick Ronson. And there was dead silence. I thought, well, that's what you get for telling the truth. It's an American label. Yeah, I actually wrote that for Mick because he's such a great player and he liked slower kind of things, you know. So he could really develop on slow. He really liked playing slow groove sort of thing. That's why I wrote that song, just to give him as a vehicle for his guitar, you know.
Hello, everybody. How are you all tonight? This is Alan Freed, the old king of the Moondoggers, and it's time again for another of your favorite rock and roll sessions as you enjoy the Moondog Show.
How did this love affair with Cleveland finally manifest itself in 1979 from the Schizophrenic album with Cleveland Rocks?
I just didn't like the way that it was like the joke of the States. Yeah. And when we went there, it was like the best gig, the most receptive audience and hip audience in America. More so than LA, more so than New York, but somehow on Carson and Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin, who were the guys at the time in the talk show, it always seemed that Cleveland was the butt of the joke. And I didn't see it like that. I thought Cleveland was a great town. So that was the whole thing, being, you know, Cleveland Rock.
One, two. Yeah.
Ian Hunter from his 1979 solo album, You're Never Alone with the Schizophrenic. And even though after four decades he has rarely strayed from the same three-chord sensibility of his boyhood inspiration Jerry Lee Lewis, nevertheless, Ian Hunter continues to rack up four-star and better reviews for his solo albums here in the 21st century.
No, I don't really, I mean, you know, everybody has a quality control, and I don't really like anything going on there that's not, you know, passable. I've always felt like that. Every time I do a record, I always do it for the right reasons. In the 80s, I kind of lost it a bit. Did a couple of records I'm not too proud of, but apart from that, you know, most of them were meant, and there was an element of truth involved, you know. Well, you never know, hopefully, you know, and the reaction to it's been quite astonishing. So, I mean, I didn't expect this kind of reaction to it. I knew it was good, but I didn't think it was... People have been great about it, you know. So hopefully it'll widen up a little bit, you know. Well, I'm actually halfway through the next one, which is like a first for me. I mean, it's always 2 or 3 years before I can even think about it, you know. But for some reason, I think it's like Lewis Black said, you know, like there's so much stuff going on, you don't know where to start. And I guess you write more in times like these, you know. And it's not actually the new stuff that I'm doing for the next one. It's not really that political at all. It's just something else. But it just kept on coming. And I'm highly delighted because, you know, when you finish a record, it's horrible because you've got nothing. It's like you're disarmed.
You're spent.
Yeah, and it takes so long to get back into it again. I lose the muscle so quick that it's great that it would continue, you know. And having to tour with it and all the rest of it is quite a pleasure because I go back to something that I've already got moving, you know.
Well, it begs the question, to what do you attribute this prolific period then?
It just seems that what's going on at the moment is like so ridiculous that it just it sparks the muse, you know.
I got a bridge I can sell ya. I got a pyramid. I got a timeshare in Florida. How'd you like a piece of it? You're making a fuss about nothing. Everything's under control. That thing in your body's got liberal. Back and relax, watch it all unfold. Never forget, I got a direct line of a man you can trust in. If it's left to the left, there won't be nothing left. You're making a fuss about nothing. This world is a ball with a map on. We conquer, we buy and we sell. This world is a tank with a tap on. Business as usual. I'm just protecting your interests. I'm just defending your faith. Those guys that were caught with their hands in the till. Nothing to do with me, mate. Nothing to do with me. Never forget, I got a direct line of a man with a mission. If it's left to the left, there won't be nothing left. Making a fuss about nothing. Don't you worry, don't you worry. I'm sure I can come up with something. When all said and done, I am the one. You're making a fuss about nothing. About nothing. I am just doing my job. You just gotta trust me on this one. Cause when the time is right, we'll get out of Dodge. Never forget, I'm doing my best. I am a man with a vision. If it's left to the left, there won't be nothing left. You're making a fuss about nothing. Don't you worry, I'm sure we can figure out something. Just leave it to me.
from his strong 2007 solo album Shrunken Heads, that's Ian Hunter with Fuss About Nothing. But there's quite a fuss this week as the Forever Young Dudes are reuniting for a handful of select Mott the Hoople performances with original members Ian Hunter, Mick Ralphs, Verdon Allen, Overend Watts, and Martin Chambers of the Pretenders filling in on drums for Dale Buffin Griffin, who is struggling with early-stage Alzheimer's disease. Tonight, Mott the Hoople plays Birmingham, Wednesday, Glasgow, Clyde Auditorium, Saturday, Newcastle City Hall, Sunday, Manchester Apollo, then next Monday, Mott the Hoople rocks the O2 Arena in London. I'm Redbeard. Thank you so much to my in-the-studio guest, Ian Hunter. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2013. All rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, @RedbeardRocks on Twitter, and for much more, check out inthestudio.net.